Greetings, comrades, and welcome to the Eastern Border. We are, after a long while, back to our longer episodes here. Annette will actually plug in our theme song. Haven't played that in a long while because of the recent events. But of course, well, this show, just like every other show on this channel until the war ends, is going to be about exactly that. The war. And today we are joined by Anthony Barthaway, the host of Ukraine Without Hype podcast. He's a journalist, an American journalist, if I'm not mistaken. I hope you're not British or Canadian, who now lives in and works in Ukraine. So please, Anthony, introduce yourself to my my glorious comrades or something. I don't know, man. This is just...
So like you said, my name's Anthony. I have lived in Ukraine for the previous 7, maybe 8 years. Who even knows time? But yeah, I'm a journalist. I have previously worked in television here. I have written a few things, but I'm not that big of a deal. And currently, my main gig is hosting Ukraine Without Hype, a podcast from, well, currently from Vinnytsia, used to be out of Kiev, but on the ground, so it were. And yes, American, but from the Detroit area, so the Canadian people are quite close to me.
I'm really, really happy to have you on because, of course, people, once I get back to the ground, yes, I will look out for Anthony and I will find him and I have to meet him in person. That is mandatory. But the main reason why we're here is the fact that specifically after what happened in the last few days, after we saw the horrible war crimes and everything, what really kind of stunned me is the fact that I knew that this was happening. And probably you knew that as well. It's just that we didn't have documentation, didn't have the pictures. But it's kind of hard to, and this kind of ties into this, I'm just seeing Western reports that they're shocked about actions of Russia. They were also shocked about the invasion. They seem to be constantly shocked about Russia doing things that people from Ukraine or the Baltics or Eastern Europe are generally telling them, no, look, this is what Russia is going to do. Hey, look, seriously. And then everyone in the West says, oh, no, we're so shocked. This surprises me. Why do you think it is?
A lot of it just seems because Russia has been looked at as this, the civilized partner, even if it was a bit, you know, of a rival or a bit hostile. It was always treated as something that was at least part of their world, which honestly, Ukraine, the Baltic states, Moldova was not treated as an equal in the same way. So I think a lot of it just becomes from familiarity. On some level, people want to think of Russia as this responsible partner in a way, even when its actions have not proved to be the case. And you're saying, like, if I may have known about this case specifically, and yeah, I had actually received a tip from a friend of a friend that it was happening, well, these massacres were happening not in Bucha specifically, but in two other towns north of Kiev, further north of Bucha, that about 2 weeks ago, I was told that they were massacring, you know, the male population of these towns.
I agree with you here because I also have my own sources in Ukraine and in Russia too, since I'm already joking that I run a small agency. But currently in Russia, 10 euros gets you in a lot of places. So thank you, patrons, your funding bribes. It's fine. But the thing is, often I've faced this issue where I explain something about Soviet Union or Russia and people just go, it's too crazy. It can't happen. People are posting on Twitter, after real news that has happened, it's like, this sounds too crazy to be believed. And yes, it does. Often it does. That's the whole point. Doesn't the idea that that Zelensky, who used to be a comedian, got elected president sound crazy to you? I don't know how to break this atmosphere of people just thinking inside their own cultural bubble, I suppose, about this region. I think you have noticed this too, but like, do you have any advice on this to our listeners maybe?
You'd think after trying to do this exact thing for as long as I have, I would have a better idea of how to communicate cultural needs to Americans better. And honestly, it's quite hard just because it's such an unknown region. You know, think about high school history classes. We might have studied a bit of the history of France, maybe Germany, definitely England, but anything east of the Oder-Neisse line is might as well be no man's land, just complete mystery and hope you figure it out later. So there's not even the baseline level understanding that someone might know. I guess if you were a Paradox Entertainment Games player, you'd know what the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth is or something like that. But other than
Rzeczpospolita.
Precisely. So there's not the base that you can build off of. People might know a little bit about that, you know, China exists. People might know a little bit that Japan exists, or they know that France did XYZ things. I have like a deep understanding, but we're able to get that just broad overview that you would from formal education or pop culture that absolutely disappears as soon as you go east. Just trying to build from there, you have to connect on it. Like, I've been working a lot with, say, Holocaust education, and that is easier to do. In that people know what the Holocaust is, people know what World War II is, which was what makes it much easier to talk about in that case. But it's hard to collapse the entirety of the culture and the entirety of the history down to this like very ultimately short time span that lacks context, either going back or going forward.
Sadly, I know exactly what you're talking about, because I think I mentioned this on the early episodes of the show, but I started my Eastern Border because I wanted someone from the local area to explain all this mess to Westerners. Mm-hmm. And my show started because I was posting on Dan Carlin's forums. But what really pushed me to it was that I listened to Slate's Political Gabfest. And they had a lady on, like, back in 2014. I don't remember her name at all. There was this lady who was invited in as Russia and Eastern European expert. And that was already great, because in her credentials, she had, like, studied for a year in Moscow and a half year in St. Petersburg. But in Moscow, she had lived in Rublevka.
That's common, yeah.
To those of you who don't know, that's like, I know United States of America. I have spent 6 months living in Times Square. Mm-hmm. Approximately that, okay? It's the poshest region ever. And then I decided that no one's doing this, so I'm really, really thankful for your show. When I started this show out, there was like no one out there who knows about this whole situation, but now I guess it falls on to us to actually explain things, because recently I've noticed that if I follow the news and I follow updates daily, then like my Ukrainian sources and Russian sources post something, I translate this into English, and I post about it on Twitter or tell it on my show, and then 2 days later you get a hot take from New York Times.
Yeah, my podcast making partner, Romeo, he made a tweet recently saying, in response to some memo that came out in the U.S. saying, if you wanted to hear us say this exact same thing a month earlier, then here's what we did. Oddly enough, an episode we made of April last year was during the initial buildup that they were doing along the border. So in our episode from last, I want to say April, we had been talking about the Russian military buildup at that time, and we basically said what we think a war with Russia would look like, the broad, larger invasion would look like. And honestly, we got it almost precisely right. In hindsight, it's kind of obvious what they would have done. There's only have so many options, but we've been harping on this for literally a year, and seeing all these people, you know, inside the Beltway in the big media production houses in New York and London act so stunned and surprised that this happened. It's like, who were you talking to? Are your sources just like, you know, Moscow intelligentsia, who had just digged their head in the sand and hope that everything stays normal for as long as possible? And the answer is, yeah, like they seek out their sources. They find them amongst the Moscow intelligentsia middle classes, who are very Pollyanna about everything that doesn't immediately affect them.
I'm lucky because I live two blocks away from Medusa.
Oh yeah, of course. The Russian
guys who moved to Riga.
Exilees are split between Riga and Prague and for a while in Kiev, less so now.
Yeah, I know. Like, I got lucky. I'm right now trying to contact Deutsche Welle, since they also moved to Riga. But my position in Riga, well, makes me well positioned to get all the news, because I go to the same bars as those journalists and we hang out. So
right, yeah.
That also, by the way, is a pro tip for listeners. If you ever need someone who speaks English in a foreign country, go to the local newspaper. You'll find someone. Mm-hmm. I can assure you. And they will help you. The local newspaper, if you're a foreigner, will actually go and aid you, and they'll go out of your way to help you because you're a news story.
And every city has its haunts where these types of people will hang out. I can think of, you know, a handful of bars
yep.
that all the journalists go to, where the Belarusian dissidents go to. Like, there's places to go.
Yeah. We are now revealing the secrets of our profession, sir.
Alcoholism, it turns out.
Alcoholism, insane amounts of coffee. I used to smoke. Now I use that white chew nicotine stuff. Which, by the way, you have to tell me. Do you have that thing in Ukraine?
I think so. I don't smoke, so I don't really know the ins and outs of it here. But I'm pretty sure, yeah.
So I used to smoke, but I quit. Now I'm just don't want to restart again. But yeah, the important part here is the fact that I'm actually stunned by the fact that a lot of experts that are in these mainstream media magazines, they are more likely from the 90s, and a lot of them have been like, oh, I've shaken hands with Shoigu, with Putin himself. Yeah, you did that in the early 2000s, and I just don't understand that at all. One thing, though, that really made me worried and interested about, and which I got a lot of flack for, especially when I went to Martyr Made podcast, Daryl Cooper's show. Oh, no, it was just so crazy because I got so much hate for the fact that I'm apparently now a neo-Nazi. Because apparently Ukraine's full of Nazis. Well, sir, you are from the United States of America. You hate Nazis more than everything. Could you please fucking tell those people about the Ukrainian Nazis? Because I'm tired.
So I readily identify as a leftist and an anti-fascist. I have been following every little thing that these people do for the last 8 years. Azov, Right Sector, Tradition, Order, all these people. I'm at their protests. I'm at their counter-protests when there's an LGBT thing going on. I have trained jiu-jitsu with several of them. I know these people. I know what they're doing. It is absolutely maddening to have that thrown back into my face that I'm suddenly a Nazi supporter because I'm opposed to the genocide of the Ukrainian people. So,
well, let me just say this first. There are, of course, radical idiots. Of course, there are there. But honestly, I don't believe that even the majority of the Azov battalion are actual Nazis.
I'd say about half of them. About half of them you could call right wing, a far right in some way. The other half don't care.
Yeah, because they're like the guys with guns who stand against Russia right now. So it's weird, okay? But I think they're not the most popular party in Ukraine, which has changed five presidents. No, sorry, six ones, while Putin has remained in power all the time. So
there has only ever been one president who won re-election in the entirety of Ukrainian history, Kuchma. The rest all lost. We recycle our politicians with great regularity. But more on, so Azov, before we drift on Kuchma.
That hurts me physically, since I trust Alexander Nevzorov. I read his book on journalism. I respect him. He doesn't speak English, therefore he's unknown in the Western world. He's kind of like the Hunter S. Thompson of the Russian-speaking world. His book on how to be a good journalist is called How to Insult People. Just understood, okay? He's literally the most trusted source that I have. And if he says that he received a letter from the Azov explaining them, and therefore I will give you that letter. Just saying, because, okay. For even translating that letter and giving them a voice, I was called a neo-Nazi. Therefore, I want to go through this Azov thing as much as we can.
Of course. So when they started off, it was founded by Andrei Beletsky, a guy who I would say, yes, is a neo-Nazi. He has said some horrific things in the past about, you know, the white race and the Jews, all that stuff. Then 2014 happens and they become. So the army essentially had been sold for scrap throughout the entirety of Ukrainian independence, especially during the Yanukovych era, to the point where when the war began, it practically did not exist. And in order to defend Ukraine from the Russian invasion, there was all these volunteer groups who formed together. Some of them were combat units. Some of them just ran supplies. But the volunteer movement was what saved the country. Some of them had far right ideology behind them. Most did not. I know left wingers and anarchists who joined many of these units, especially Dnipro attracted a lot of the left, but that's kind of off the point. But Azov, they distinguished themselves in the defense of Mariupol. Now, some of, I'd say the PR was a bit behind their backs at point where other people did not get the credit that they deserved. But point being, Azov kind of walked out of the retaking of Mariupol, which had been held by pro-Russian intelligence-backed militants of this or that variety. I want to say a month. There's a period of time where the city was contested, including by local cops who became turncoats. And because Azov was able to at least portray itself as the saviors of the city, which was probably one of the most important battles of that war, along with Slovyansk, they were able to gain this massive status. And so if you wanted to join a unit that seemed to know what it could do, that had the equipment to give to you, Azov was not a terribly bad choice. Now, for a while, they were able to operate independently, but very, very early on, the Ukrainian government, through the Ministry of the Interior, was able to bring all these volunteer units into a centrally organized government position, and they all became at least officially depoliticized. And when this happened, a lot of the original, I guess you'd say, political operatives from its independence era left the unit because I just don't think they wanted to be told what to do. And they went into localizing as political figures, essentially. From that point on, the Azov Battalion continued to receive training from the broader Azov movement, which is, you know, the Azov Regiment, plus the civilian political organizations formed by the same people. There is always a level of debate over how close the Azov Regiment and the civilian political side were. It wasn't zero, but it also wasn't total. It was somewhere in between. But it was always acted under the command of the Ukrainian government after that point, and at least officially was depoliticized. Meanwhile, the civilian side formed the National Corps, and a bunch of, you know, splinter organizations that were more or less attached to the Azov movement, whether or not you'd want us to consider them part of it. Some of these were definitely more extreme than others. A National Corps tried to portray itself as just basically a youth movement. Like, they had a cool clubhouse. They really avoided the darker side of their politics. It was still there, but they really wanted to make sure that that wasn't what people associated with them with. They really kind of hid it underneath. Honestly, most of these people, part of this movement, were teenagers. Some of them were described to me as, you know, the C student types who might not have been outstanding in other fields, but they would go to this clubhouse that would, you know, they had good MMA clubs, they had a good gym, like animal welfare branch where you would help out rescue dogs.
Well, let me explain that part. Animal welfare is super important here because that's a Soviet tradition. That is very Soviet-y because of how all of our protests for independence started from the Green Movement. If you remember that one, the Gulf of Botany is totally damaged. So it's kind of in our genes to care about animals a lot.
Yeah, I've seen them doing like forest cleanups. Like
in Latvia, sorry to interrupt you, but like in Latvia, we have two official national holidays per year where all that we do is go out to our forests and clean them up.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
It's a thing because, like, this is what we do. Because I know Ukraine is tons and tons of farmland and they have a lot of forest and everything. So, yeah, people just do activities as far as I know. I don't know. Of course, there are some Nazis, but I think I'll be hard pressed to find Nazis in Odessa.
I mean, they're there, but not Not in large numbers.
Nazis in Odessa probably get beat up by local Jews anyway. So,
yeah, Odessa's a Jewish town. That's ours. But
I am Jew enough to say that Odessa, where I'm going, is a great place. It has a monument, Ostap Bender. And if you haven't read Ilf and Petrov's 12 Chairs, shame on you. Do that. It's amazing.
Go to the Moldavanka and just absorb Jewish-speaking Russian history.
Dude, I have a... To explain Odessa to my listeners, because I have to inject some humor in this. I have a joke from Odessa for this. This comes straight from Odessa from a listener, so if anyone yells at me for anti-Semitism, no, this comes from Odessa Jews, just like 90% of Odessa Jewish jokes. So, Abramovich walks down the street and sees a store where his friend is just clapping on the entry, "We don't sell milk and meat to Jews." Then he goes and says, "Hey, Yosuke, you're just as much Jew as I am. What the hell are you doing?" And he responds, "Well, have you tried my milk? It's awful. Why would I sell it to Jews?"
That's about right, yeah.
That is Ashkenazi humor for you. This is what it is.
Odessa is the city that you ran away to when everything else was too boring. That's what Odessa is. It was the city that grew up around mobsters and comedians and actors and just various outcasts. And it's still basically a mob town. The mayor there, Trihanov, is not a nice fellow. I'm pretty sure he has murdered someone with his bare hands at some point or another. But that's actually part of why it's being so defended right now. And this is an important point, is that the people of Odessa are extreme patriots. For Odessa.
I am from Riga. Mm-hmm. I am going to Odessa. I will be an Odessite for at least a month.
God, I hope things are still open there for you, because that's a great city.
I definitely want to see there, because seeing today how things were bombed with all the situation is putting my hopes down. But you know what? Who cares? For one, I know that there's a certain thing that we Eastern Europeans do. When things get tough, we get funny.
All Russian language humor originates in Odessa.
At least 90% of. I attest to this. If you have heard a Russian Soviet political joke on my show, it comes from Odessa. By the way, I've noticed one interesting thing, because in modern days, they literally take out Abramovich as central character of these jokes. And they just replaced it with a Moscow man. Abramovich is Jewish.
Oh, no. They got rid of Abramovich? I thought it would just be because there's a very particular Abramovich that you don't want to be too attached to.
Well, of course, I think, but like now they're telling the joke about the newspaper with the obituary on the first page, and that's not Abramovich anymore, because I think it might offend some Jews. Look, my grandma was Jewish. I don't claim to be Jewish enough, but I can pretty much attest to you that no Ashkenazi will get offended for Soviet jokes that originated in Odessa. Like, none of them. Because those jokes are not offensive to Jews. They're made up by Jews, yeah.
They're made up by Jews. They are owned by the Jewish people. That is their cultural heritage of post-Soviet Jews, Odessa jokes.
That is why I followed Odessa since the first day of the invasion, and I just loved it. I loved how that hadn't lost its spirit. For example, there was this poster on the wall that stated that, "Welcome to Ukraine! We give you free cocktails!" That was just amazing. And the best thing happened when I was sent a picture, which was like, you know, those tank hedgehogs that they put in places now? Mm-hmm. And one of them said, "Kosher hedgehogs from the Jews of Odessa."
Yeah, there's a bunch of them. Like the Dnipro Jewish community as well has really organized.
But I have another one, because I'm very sorry. I'm just extra depressed today, so I have to inject some humor here. It has to be done.
Has to be done.
This is a modern political joke. Again, from Odessa. Of course it's from Odessa. Abramovich gets a call. Oh, and Russian soldiers arrive, and they're like, "Oh, you are a fascist. You support Zelensky. You are all neo-Nazis." And Abramovich is like, yeah, we all with the whole synagogue.
Hello there, and thanks for listening to another episode of The Eastern Border. Dear Patreons, thank you more than ever for supporting our show. Your donations are crucial to keep us going, and right now all of your money is going to securing good information for you and to fund Kristaps' actual real-life mission to Ukraine to report to you live about the war that is going on there. Also, we would like to use this opportunity to urge you to donate to other organizations that are helping people escape Ukraine safely and to defend the country for those who decide to stay on the ground. One such organization we would like to highlight is the Defending Ukraine Together Come Back Alive movement. Launched in 2014, the Come Back Alive became the biggest organization providing support to the armed forces of Ukraine. You can donate directly from their webpage, comebackalive.in.ua. Remember that no donation is too small. In this situation, every dollar matters, every cent matters. If you're uncomfortable with giving money to war, they do have a position on their website that they are providing Ukrainian army with laptops, lights, photo equipment, cables, and is not purely military. Perhaps that might change your mind, but remember you can also donate to strictly humanitarian organizations such as the Red Cross and others that are helping people escape Ukraine safely. Please also keep following us on social media for all of your latest updates on Eastern Border on places like Twitter and Facebook. Keep listening, keep yourself informed. That's all from me now. See you online.
Well, if you listen to the Ukrainian Russian propaganda from the very start of the war, we're all a bunch of gay Jew Nazis, and they managed to twist it all together into a single bad guy. Like, pick one.
Dude, that's the thing. When I previously told on my show that there are only Nazis in Western Europe, there are gay Nazis, Jew Nazis, liberal Nazis, Western Nazis, pasta-eating Nazis, I don't know, football-playing Nazis, Nazi-Nazi, everyone's a Nazi. And people didn't believe me, because for the Russians, they are the only anti-fascists in the world. I completely presume that they would treat you as an anti-fascist Nazi.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I'm already Jewish and they hate that. I mean, I'm a leftist. They hate that.
Which is paradoxical because they hate the Western left as well. And when you present news from Russia to someone who's at least somewhat reasonable, they just don't believe you.
The problem here is they don't understand that when a Russian says Nazi, they don't mean the same thing. They see the only sin that the Nazis did was invade Russia. Everything else is kind of a detail in that.
Killing Jews? Totally okay. Hating on gay people? Absolutely fucking amazing. Invading Russia? That's a big boo-boo.
Look at what was happening in the immediate aftermath of the war. What was Stalin supposed to say? Like, it's bad to slaughter entire ethnicity of people as he does it to the Chechens and the Ingush and the Tatars and the Latvians before the war. Like,
thank you for remembering us.
They can't take a qualified stance against ethnic cleansing when they're in the middle of doing that and saying that the reason was okay is because these are internal enemies of the Soviet people. They can't treat it like that. So it has to be that the purpose, the reason that the Nazis were bad was only because they attacked Russia. And if you look at, say, I've been to the siege museum, the Leningrad Siege Museum in St. Petersburg, and you would see these, you know, frescoes and art and displays where they very much treated the Nazis as just another Western invasion. They compared it to Napoleon, the Teutonic Knights against Alexander Nevsky. It was considered a part of a continuous historical movement of the West attacking Russia.
That was the worst part about this whole discussion. I have to facepalm all the time because for me and you, those are obvious truths. But I've spent, like, since 2014, about 8 years explaining this to Western people, and they still don't understand it. That's the number one thing, because, look, to my listeners, you all know this already, but maybe you'll share this podcast to someone who's new to this whole situation. When people like me or Anthony are telling you, please listen to the people who live in these parts, we know what's up, maybe you sort of should. Why? Because we know this stuff, and this hurts me the most. This situation, well, I can just congratulate you, because Ukraine after the war is going to be, I think there's going to be a Marshall Plan 2.0, and Ukraine's going to get rebuilt. I know that I shall help in this process, because one thing that I have to explain to my listeners is the fact that there is a real post-Soviet unity, at least with everyone who is not Russia, because Ukrainians haven't invaded us. This whole idea of unity seems kind of nice. But we started this conversation about predictions about Russia, and I wanted to get on this because the economical situation is dire there. And right now, Kurils are being claimed by Japan once again. And I personally believe that as soon as any reforms whatsoever pass or Putin leaves power in any way or form, Chechnya will not be a part of Russia. It cannot be done. Just as soon as Ramzan Kadyrov is gone, Chechnya is out. I used to believe that either Russia will turn into the world's largest North Korea or it will turn into nothing, because I believe and claim that it's a colonial empire. You know, just like the British Empire, except its colonies are just stuck to it in its land form. Basically, the Moscow and St. Petersburg are the metropolis, and everywhere else is the colonies. That's how I view Russia, personally. And I believe it's going to fall apart. It's pretty much unavoidable in my eyes. What do you think?
Yeah, so in that way, that is a very common way of looking at Russia right now. It's being more and more seen as an imperial center versus the imperial periphery. And at the moment, that's mostly being said by, you know, Ukrainian, Belarusian, Baltic, Caucasian, Central Asian scholars to try to put it within a larger, like, post-colonial framework, the same way that scholars would look like at Africa, for example. But yes, this point of the Russian Federation itself being an empire also needs to be examined more. So you started as a history podcast, so it's easier for me to kind of get a bit wonkish with going back in time and all that. But When Russia is being formed, like, the whole idea of calling it Russia was to stake a claim on what is now Belarus and Ukraine, to say that it is the legitimate inheritor of the legacy of Kiev and Rus.
Let me self-promote here. I literally wrote about this in Foreign Policy magazine, which you can check out.
Of course.
Talking about this, by the way, because when Putin made his nonsense speech about his historical stuff, Foreign Policy calls me up that night and tells me, hey, dude, our translators are just translating this and this makes no sense. You have until 6 a.m. in the morning to translate historical parts. And I'm like, what the fuck, guys?
Six. Okay, as of someone who's done plenty of freelance work, that sounds like an awful time scale to work on. But
yeah, from 10 a.m. from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. I literally, if you look up my article on Foreign Policy magazine about the historicity of Putin's speech, I did that in 8 hours, and I don't remember the next day because I probably went on a drinking binge because. Like, argument consists of, okay, so Putin claims this, but this has nothing to do with Donbass. And then he claims this, which is bullshit, and also has nothing to do with Donbass. And also, I want to die now because he makes no sense. And this also has nothing to do with Donbass.
Yeah, none of it. Yeah, my heart goes out to you. That sounds miserable. But yeah, the issue there is it began as an imperial identity in order to justify the conquest of other regions.
Let me explain this. Belarus means white Russia. Ukraine is, they call it Ukraine, and there's a lot of issues about the origin of the word, but how Russians call Ukraine are Malorossi, or sometimes Novorossi.
The little Russians.
The little Russians.
Yeah, Russia sees Ukrainians as a weird local version of Russians that speak with a funny accent. And not as a separate people in any way. And that is functionally why Russia was created. And when this imperial ideology was being put together, one weird fact that always stands out to me was at the time, Muscovy did not have an intelligentsia of its own. They did not have a single university. So after they were able to conquer Kiev, they were able to conquer their first university, what is now the Kiev Mihyla Academy, the Kiev Academy. And it is the scholars who were there, Ukrainian scholars, who kind of first began to form this greater Russian imperial ideology, partially as a way to justify their own position as something other than the original Muscovite nobility, to create this big empire that would include all the Rus people. So Russia needed to basically conquer Ukraine in order to have the intellectual firepower in order to create this ideology in the first place. And that always blew my mind.
Dude, really, really stuns me at all times. We here in the Baltics, we're not even Slavic. Estonians are Finno-Ugric. They're Finnish. Us and Lithuanians, we're Baltic bros. Meanwhile, hello. Hello, Russia. You want our lands constantly. Again, you might not believe this, my dear listeners, but when I go to Lithuania, there's a lot of old ladies in the market that don't speak English. And I go to them and I start speaking in Russian, but my first sentence is always, Я из Прибалтики, я латыш, which means I'm from the Baltics and I'm a Latvian. Why? Because they're Lithuanian. If you go to a pub anywhere in the post-Soviet sphere, and you know that you can speak English with the younger generation, but you have to speak Russian with the older generation. Mm-hmm. Everyone will always start by explaining that they are not Russian, that they're from the post-Soviet sphere, and currently they might throw in Putin Huilo as well, just for good measure. That's the issue, because one thing that I don't get is that a lot of people in the West think that Ukraine should give up its lands and territory just so there would be peace. That peace is something that we have seen in Bucha today, we have seen in many other places. Why are so many people so interested into this fact that, oh no, well, just to stop the war, Zelensky should give up that and this? You might have a different take on this because you've lived in Ukraine, but you're an American. You understand that culture better than I do. I'm just Latvian. But for me as a Latvian, I grew up here. This is my land. If someone would say that, hey, Russians have invaded your land, so now you give up all of Latgale so the Russians would stop invading you, I'd rather die. I don't understand how to explain this because, hey, no, this is our land and we kind of, you know, like our land being our land with our people. What's this idea? Do the people really think that we'd rather trade our self-sufficiency for something, or do we need to be puppets or everyone? I just don't get the point completely.
Well, it's always very easy to ask other people to sacrifice things. So if you're a continent and an ocean away, it's very easy to say, why can't Ukraine just give up X, Y, and Z? Because it's not you having to give anything up, it's somebody else. And that's just such a patronizing, quite frankly, imperialistic attitude to have that it truly turns my stomach. Part of it, I believe, has to do with they do believe the idea that, you know, Ukrainians are just like another type of Russian, right? Because that's kind of how it was told when older people now heard growing up during the Cold War, like it's all Russia, it's all just Russia, which the people here very much disagree with.
I have heard the same thing to a less extent, but like, oh, you're Latvian? Is that Russia?
I once walked into a wine store in America. I was looking for Georgian wine specifically because that's what I like. And like, oh, you mean like Russia? And I nearly had a heart attack. Like, say that to a Georgian and walk away with your body intact. It's like it kind of goes back to that ignorance that I was talking about earlier. No one knows anything about what happens east of Germany. And so there's already that built-in idea that it's all the same anyway. Where does it matter where the border is?
Look, I actually do have some hope for Americans, specifically Americans. Mm-hmm. You know why? Because Western Europeans, in a way, have always looked at us here in the East with some arrogance. Mm-hmm. It has happened. Italians, nothing against those people at all. You know, because I recently visited Rome, and wow, Rome truly deserves to be called the ancient city. Meanwhile, if someone tries to give you pasta carbonara with sour cream, tell them to go and go where the Russian warship went, and it's amazing. Rome is great. However, we do deserve some respect, and I believe that actually Americans culturally have way more in common with us here in Eastern Europe than you have the West. Because Western Europe is more like the posh guys, you know, they're the hipsters of Europe. Mm-hmm. They're the posh guys who are always the coolest guys. But one thing that we always say here in Eastern Europe is that how can you spot an Eastern European? We always in the kitchen have a little plastic bag in which all the other plastic bags are held, which you use for trash or anything else. We have a bag for bags.
Is that not a thing everywhere?
No, that isn't. That's a thing only in Eastern Europe and in America.
Huh.
I've been to both places. Western Europeans who listen to this are now super shocked because, yes, bag for bags is a super Eastern European thing and a super American thing.
Who are these people? That's what you do with a plastic bag. You put
in you put it in the bag for bags, right? You're one of us now. One of us,
wonderful.
Comrade. But, like, that does not happen in Germany. That does not happen in Italy or Spain or France or Portugal or UK. They don't have the bag for bags.
Savages. Savages, all of them.
Pure barbarians. But this is a thing. And I believe that Western Europe's now growing its balls, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But I would like them to get tougher or something, but...
I'm surprised. I'm surprised of how much they're pulling too. Like, I still have my disappointments, of course, but... It's better than I thought it would be. I can definitely say that.
See, I would like everyone to go tougher on Ukraine. On the other hand, I kind of want a country to return to when I get back from Ukraine. This whole situation is a fucking mess, to be honest. It's a mess, and I don't know how to deal with it.
And part of this, I just want to say as well, this idea of a lot of, you know, Western Europeans or Americans calling Ukraine Nazis. I don't believe there's any current far-right politicians within the Ukrainian parliament from the far-right parties. Look at Italy. Alexander Mussolini has a career.
There was an asshole who responded to me about this. He told me, oh yeah, Ukrainian neo-Nazis only got 1.5%. However, their neo-Nazis, I mean Ukrainian ones, are far worse because they want to exterminate all non-Ukrainians. And I'm like, Ukrainians are Slavs. Your Eastern Slavic peoples. What? I mean...
It's absurd. Like, look at France. Look at their far-right parties. Look at Italy. Look at their far-right parties. Even Germany, their alternative for Germany is far, far larger than anything that exists in Ukraine. Yet Ukraine is the one.
Azov might be neo-Nazis, but Azov represents less than 1% of the population.
All of their parties put together... got, 1.5 to 2% of the vote. And a lot of that is just like old people who automatically think that everything is anti-Soviet is therefore good. and that's the beginning and end of their logic.
I think that a lot of people also ignore the fact that people who don't know our area, they treat Ukrainians as Nazis, but what they don't get is the fact that if Kharkiv, okay, it's Kharkov in Latvian, we're now switching all of our pronunciation. I will still call Chernobyl,
yeah, it's
sadly,
a whole thing.
Because that's what I'm used to, but I can call Kyiv. Things you don't know about Kharkov and Mariupol is the fact that those are majority Russian-speaking cities, and I've been to Mariupol.
Mm-hmm.
Those are not places with Ukrainian nationalists in them. That's why they're being destroyed, because Putin's just angry that the Russian-speaking Ukrainians are not giving up. Guess what?
If you look at some of these Ukrainians who might have even seen themselves as like closer to Russia, might have people who we might call them, you know, the little Russians, the Ukrainians who kind of think of themselves that way. Even most of them have snapped into place because even if Russia's the big brother, big brother's trying to murder you. So you try to murder him back. Even when they're people who do feel that cultural connection now, like the boxer Usyk, he was very much a... Russia-friendly guy, and he joined a territorial defense unit to fight against Russia. Any lingering closeness that people might have felt towards Russia has been completely abused and is not going to be tenable in the future at all, especially now after Bucha.
That's the thing, because Ukraine has its own issues, like reconciliating the West and the East part of the country, because Lvov and Kharkiv are two different... How would they say in Odessa? Две большие разницы. In English, that would be two big differences, but not quite. But not quite. There are nuances there. Right now, Ukrainian identity is being born. And Zelensky is a national hero. And I'm just really happy that, for one, I know that, well, all the Baltics down with Ukraine, all of us, we're completely on the same wave. One thing, though, is that I personally believe that after this is over, I think that Zelensky should not run for president. I think that his push is a bit too large. Like, if we look at the bigger picture, because I believe Russia is going to split apart, but the right thing for Zelensky to do when this is over is actually to step down and not run for office again. Because he can only go down from here.
Yeah.
If he gets reelected, he'll get bogged into everyday corruption and politics and all this stuff, and he'll just tarnish his reputation. There is no way how can he get, like, he's at the peak. He's at a political peak. He should just say that war is over, I'm retiring, elect someone else.
That's definitely his stance. I don't know if he'd be able to do that.
Look, I'm a Battletech fan, okay? I'm a Battletech fan. He's in the position of Kerensky now. I used to be a 40K fan, by the way, but Games Workshop fucked my game. Imperial Guard forever, by the way. But, like, in Battletech terms, he now oversees this and he's the leader. However, if he gets reelected in Ukraine, what I didn't like about Zelensky before was that Pyotr Poroshenko wasn't as corrupt. Those accusations were iffy, and there's a lot of sticky stuff that no one remembers right now. I firmly believe that, like, if Zelensky goes for office after this is over, no one can beat him.
No, none. He's a hero right now.
If he wants to run for office after this is over, he will get the office. The real problem is that I think that if he does so, Ukrainians have built their state unity. They've built their national identity. And I think that's more important than... Zelensky has a lot of money. He doesn't need the money. I think that he can ruin this whole unity aspect. And he can fuck it up. And I believe that shouldn't be done. I believe that Zelensky should step down as the military leader and say that I'm retiring. And he'll get a monument built to him. And people will just love him forever for the rest of his life.
Zelensky, before the war, he had a problem with not being very good at the whole doing government thing. He was very inexperienced. He did not know how to handle the different power blocks very well. There was a lot of issues with just he could not recruit a very good team. But then the war started, and it turned out the one thing that is very, very useful when there's a war is charisma. Charisma and the ability to make people feel good. And Zelensky is extremely good at that because he's an actor and a comedian. He knows how to stand up there. I'm going to give him all the credit in the world for his personal bravery. But the precise skill involved here is the ability to communicate and the ability to look like everything is fine. And he's perfect for the situation.
Here I'm going to throw a bit of offense to my fellow podcasters and a friend of mine, by the way. There's a podcast called... The Dangerous History Podcast by CJ Kilmer. Mm-hmm. And he's a libertarian. I love him. Like, he's my friend, honestly. And he kings up the martyr, mate. Again, I hang out with those libertarian podcasts, but he honestly thought and posted that Zelensky couldn't have written his own speech to the United States Congress because it was just too well written. And you know what? I disagreed with this because...
I have seen people say that it must have been like American speechwriters doing... I have never heard an American politician speech as good as what Zelensky is turning out on a daily basis. So no, it's him. It's him.
That was my point. CIA would have never written a speech as good as this one. And this is because, you know what? Like I always tell my listeners, for one, I'm a Latvian. Out of all the American people who live in America, I feel most closely related to your Native Americans, to your Pawnees, to your Iroquois, because I too was declared a crusade against. My own people were slaughtered. We are Latvians and everyone in the Baltics here are basically, we just managed to survive to the modern era. But this whole idea also kind of shows this idea, and I like those shows. Please don't do anything bad to the guy. It's just a thing that I need to say out loud so that it reaches a wider audience. The very fact that everything has to have CIA involvement in it undermines our own agenda. We are not pawns of people. We can make our own decisions.
Well, if there is one thing that an American believes about the world, it's that America is the ultimate protagonist of the world, and everything that happens is because we do it, either good or bad. And that seems to be one of the big stumbling blocks. Like, I could go off for an eternity. I did a whole podcast episode about it, about why different factions.
Well, which one? Please do name the episode so that people can find it.
Yes. So we called it episode 13, Ukrainian Journalism Style Guide and Jacques, where we kind of run down why the far left and the far right both get Ukraine wrong, each for its own reasons. A lot of the far left still, for some reason, believes that Moscow is, the center of the global leftist international socialism, whereas the right sees Russia as the center of this global reactionary revolution of an ultra-conservative, you know, strongman leader, and they want that as well. But what a lot of it comes down to is Americans see everything as relating to America and not happening independent of America, especially a small, unimportant country like Ukraine.
Pro tip, Ukraine is neither small nor unimportant.
Of course. But it's seen that way because all countries are seen that way compared to the greatness of America, to the point where no one else can make decisions for themselves. If Ukraine is fighting for its independence, it must be because CIA handlers are forcing Zelensky not to surrender. If Ukraine thinks that it is a real country, a Russian will believe that's because the CIA tricked them into thinking that they're a real country when really they're just Russians. So ultimately, everything comes down to Ukraine being an object of history rather than a subject of history, something that things happen to rather than something that does things. And that's where a lot of the problems come from. Taking away agency from anyone that you don't see as like yourself. And that manifests itself in different ways. But you first have to believe that Ukrainians are capable of making their own decisions before you can learn anything or really understand the situation at all outside of gross stereotypes and bizarre conspiracy theories.
Well, I have to agree with you there, and I can go in a lot of ways. Like you said, you're a leftist. For me, I was born in the Soviet Union. I can't be a leftist. But then again, for you and for me, what's a leftist differentiates a lot.
Well, it is easier in Ukraine because we have Nestor Makhno to be our shining example.
I suppose. For us, a leftist is the person who wants to take away your cow and put planned economy in place. Because over here in Latvia and the Baltics, it was the leftist parties who supported Putin.
Well, and all the parties in Ukraine that call themselves communist, quote unquote, are just like arch conservative KGB puppets that a lot of them
exactly
work for the Russian Orthodox Church and are in fact the ones that tried to pass the anti-LGBT laws before Maidan put an end to it. So yeah, the communists did that here.
That was supposed to be my thesis about the fact that left and right doesn't mean what you think it means over here at all. And I consider myself a centrist because I want to eliminate bullshit from politics. I don't care about ideologies. I just want, you know, reasonable things done in reasonable time, you know, making things run. I believe in regulations and I believe in some markets not being totally fair, such as healthcare. Socialized healthcare, sir, is not a socialism. Socialized healthcare is reasonable. Just so you knew, my American friends, healthcare is not a market that you can choose. Just say it, but that's for another episode.
Just throwing out there that I got a MRI scan for roughly $50 here, whereas in America, it would have cost me several hundred. So nana nana boo boo.
What hurts me the most is the fact that if you get carried to ambulance by a helicopter in the United States, you get bankrupt yourself. That scares me. You know how much money I paid for my 2 master's degrees?
Very little.
Nada. Nada. Because, well, in Latvia, we don't have universal payment for this. I literally have to work my ass off because I come from a poor family. I had to be in the top 10% of my class every year, but I managed that.
One time I was in the midst of an extreme flu. I was sick to the point of delirium, and my coworkers, because I was at work at the time, were trying to call an ambulance for me. I was very insistent that they not do this because I did not have the money to afford an ambulance. I was saying, no, no, please don't do that. I can't afford it, until they explained to me, what are you talking about? Do you think an ambulance costs money?
Wait. I didn't know. The ambulance costs money in the United States?
Quite expensive. Quite expensive, yes.
Well, you got to be shitting me.
Oh, it's a horror show. Yeah, so that's why.
Okay, do you know how much I paid for my ambulance call when I had a ruptured appendix, when they literally saved my life?
Zero, I assume?
No, a bit more because I had to stay in the hospital for a few days. 70 euros. 70 euros in total.
I stayed in a hospital here for a full week with the flu. All I did was spend money on medicine. It was quite cheap, but I didn't actually have to spend money to stay in the hospital.
That's the thing about the societies here. Know about you, America, and again, I'm not equipped for this, but this healthcare and education are the two things that I, as a centrist, I can agree with my leftist person here, since those are just more benefits to society in general. If you keep people healthy, they'll produce more. If you keep people educated, they'll produce more, and they'll go to prison less. So in total, if you look at the data, then it's kind of like you can either spend money on welfare or on prisons. And if you spend it on welfare, then you get more money in return.
You'd really think that would be the logic, but unfortunately, no. And yeah, that's a large driver for a lot of leftists.
And I am not a leftist. I am a centrist. Definitely. I believe also in nuclear power, but that's for another time. But yeah, we went way off rails here. Let's try to lumble this one up, but...
Maybe a different time.
I'll come and visit you in Ukraine, definitely. Mm-hmm. Thanks for coming here. It's just the fact that, to be honest, after the Bucha today, I really, really needed this talk. Mm-hmm. I really needed to vent out a bit. And thank you for being patient with me. I am nowhere near as professional as you are.
I almost skipped over it saying, but yeah, like people telling Ukrainians to just surrender, we now know exactly what it looks like when Russia takes over a place. And it is mass murder, mass rape, mass looting, just a massive frenzy of war crimes. So no, we cannot allow any territory to be given up to Russia. It's what's been happening in Donbass to a lower level for the last 8 years in the different prison camps there. Just the scenes of people who are released from being tortured. The Russian world is one of torture and abuse and pain. And the fewer people, the fewer Ukrainians specifically have to live under that system, the better.
Thank you, Anthony. Thank you a lot. You are way more competent in all this than I am. You sound more competent, definitely.
No, I've been listening to your podcast, you know, pretty much since episode like 4 or something. It's been of great use to me. So if anything that I can help you out with anytime.
Look, man, all I hope is that I'm not a pile of trash. That's all I can hope for. Because honestly speaking, I don't have Joe Rogan's audience. I don't have anything. I don't have any big corps backing me up, and I've been told that I'm a CIA shell. And I'm like, yes, please, I would like to. But no Bitcoin for Christops. No Bitcoin for Christops. And what do? We do our job. Let's do our job well. And see you in Ukraine.
See you.
Slava Ukraini.
Vorom Slava.
Thank you for listening to the Eastern Border Show. If you have any questions or comments, go to our website, theeasternborder.lv, and leave a comment there. Or email us at theeasternborder@gmail.com. We'll be sure to answer. You can also follow us on social media and contact us there. If you enjoyed this episode, then leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and tell your friends about us. It really helps us grow the show. And remember, happiness is mandatory.